You've tuned to The Turley Frequency, starring your host, Kevin Turley, with guest stars Mike Romano and Reed Hodges, and special guest stars, the members of the FCC, whom we respect respectfully. Now, time to get tuned into The Frequency. Call the show at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. Or text us at 251-928-2111. And now we cross live to the Archangel Radio Studios in downtown Fairhope to at last feel the Turley Frequency.
Yes, good morning and welcome to this Thursday edition of the Turley Frequency. Today on the show, we meet military chaplain Father Peter Pomposello and discuss his life and work, and in particular, his work in recruiting more priest chaplains to the services. We speak to Father Peter in the next segment. Top of the hour, we pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and you are invited to join us. Feel free to text me your prayer requests on 251-928-2111. The lines are open for you right now. In the final segment today, we continue to explore good summer reading for all ages. And today we look at books for children with Jessica Thornton from Catholic Ventures and that company's innovative idea entitled Lion and Lamb. Stay tuned to the last segment to find out more. Okay, with all this good stuff, let's get this show on the road. Yes, welcome back to the Turley Frequency here on Archangel Radio on this Thursday, this rather somber Thursday, for reasons that we know, reasons that we've been following all week. Putting it bluntly, time is running out. Time is running out for the five men trapped in the Ocean Gate Titan submersible, missing somewhere still in the North Atlantic. When the Titan vessel set out to dive to the bottom of the ocean and film the wreck of the Titanic last Sunday, it was carrying approximately 96 hours worth of oxygen, which should have been more than sufficient for what was effectively an 8-hour dive. Reports today suggest that that oxygen level, that supply of oxygen within this ship, is, as I speak, coming to its end. The reports vary, and we'll talk a little bit about them maybe more in a moment, but this morning, some people were suggesting that the oxygen supply would run out at about 12 noon, others that it would run out now, just at the top of this hour. And we will explain a little bit of what happens next in that. But before we do so, let's have a little recap on this whole business. I'm sure you've heard of this. It's been wall-to-wall media for I don't know how many days. Well, since Sunday, since the submersible went descending into the ocean and disappearing an hour and 45 minutes later when it lost radio contact. Let's play audio file one and just get the latest from the BBC on what is happening with this vessel.
One sec, Kevin, and we'll have that for you.
Okay. So what we're going to do is just set the scene for anybody who's just tuned in overnight. There's been a flurry of activity this side with the media catching up on what's happening from the Coast Guard last night in the U.S. and the various pronouncements.
Ready now, Kevin.
Okay. So let's find out the latest from the news.
The search operation has been running through the night, and we know there are two main elements to it. They've deployed aircraft from the US and from Canada as well to scour the surface of the ocean to look for any signs that the vessel might have actually managed to re-emerge after it began its dive on Sunday morning. Then the other thing they're doing is dropping sonar buoys onto the surface of the ocean. That's to detect any activity underneath the water. They can listen to a depth of 13,000 feet, which would be deep enough to listen down to the seabed where the wreckage of the Titanic lies. Now, step one is, of course, trying to find the vessel. Step two would then be trying to recover it. And many believe that if it is deep underwater, that is going to be extremely difficult. What the US Coast Guard has said is that if that is the eventuality, they'll be working with the US Navy, the Canadian Navy, and the private sector as well to see what might be possible.
Okay, thank you for that, Reid. Now, I don't know about you, but I found the music behind that really inappropriate. It's like music out of some sort of film where, you know, there's going to be some sort of happy ending. The situation is dire. The situation is extremely serious. Any people who know about the whole business of marine salvage or even the ex-marine bodies, whether they be commercial or military, they speak in very somber terms about what is happening to this vessel and the likelihood of it being recovered. And let's just recap why they went down almost 4 miles down into the ocean. What were they looking for? Well, it was the wreck of the Titanic. Do you remember? The Titanic that sank in April 1912, when more than 1,500 people lost their lives. At the time, it was the deadliest sinking of a single ship. And to this day, it remains the deadliest peacetime sinking of an ocean liner or a cruise ship. But what people may know about the Titanic, they've seen the films, they've read the books, they've seen the various TV shows on it, they've got an idea what the Titanic is all about. But what they probably have forgotten in this latest media blitz is that the wreck of the Titanic was not discovered until 1985. Sank in 1912, and the wreck wasn't discovered to 1985. To be exact, it was two wrecks. Remember, the Titanic broke in half. One wreck ended up at one part of a canyon and the other at the other. It was a Franco-American expedition in 1985, finally discovered it. And since its initial discovery, the wreck of the Titanic has received many visits from explorers, scientists, filmmakers, salvagers, and of course, tourists. And these various individuals have recovered many thousands of items from the debris field for various conservation and public display purposes. But here's the thing, the ship's condition has deteriorated significantly over the years, partly because of accidental damage of all the people going down or some of the vessels being sent down to explore it. But at the moment, there is an accelerated rate of what's known as an iron-eating bacteria on the hull. And in 2006, it was estimated that within 50 years of 2006, so 2056, that the hull and structure of the Titanic would eventually collapse entirely due to this iron-eating bacteria, leaving only the more durable interior fittings of the ship intermingled with a pile of dust on the sea floor. It really is a case of ashes to ashes, dust to dust. But that's what these five men were going to look at, the remains of this. Now, let's get the very latest. This update came about an hour ago. It's audio file 2 we're going to play for you now. And this, again, is from the BBC. It's done a very good coverage on this, but it will give you some idea of the problems now, or the immediate problems of the search parties trying to locate this vessel, which is currently lost. So, Reid, if we could play audio file 2.
A key phase now in the search for this OceanGate Titan submersible, which launched to the wreck of the Titanic on Sunday. Now, we're told that it went down with just less than 100 hours of breathable oxygen. Now, what can we say about the conditions that are inside for the five occupants? Well, they won't be pleasant. It's almost certainly very cold. The temperatures at the base of the Atlantic Ocean, they're fridge-like, less than 4 degrees. There's probably a lot of condensation inside. And as well as declining oxygen levels, the CO2, the carbon dioxide, that's probably going up. The occupants could soon be losing consciousness. But in truth, and I stress this, we don't really know the life support limits of this sub. What we do know is that the search is ongoing. Now, we had some good news in the week because they detected some underwater noises. These were Canadian planes that were coming over that had buoys on the surface of the ocean, and they could hear things.
With respect to the noises, we don't know what they are.
And we have to hope that those sounds can zero in the search teams to find the sub on the floor of the Atlantic. That's our best chance.
Thank you, Reid. So that's the latest, okay? So it's given you an idea of some of the challenges on the surface for those seeking this vessel. Now, remember what I said. It took them 70-odd years to actually find the wreck of the Titanic. And that was a huge wreck. It was a huge ship, an ocean-going liner that sank to the bottom of the ocean, and it took them 70-odd years, scientists and explorers, to actually track down where that vessel was. The vessel that the research parties are looking for today is, in comparison, like a small insect of some description. It is tiny, absolutely tiny, in the vastness of the search area that is currently being investigated. The U.S. Coast Guard last night said that the potential area, the possible area where which they have to search and look for the vessel, is roughly the same size as Connecticut twice over. And remember, 1,000 feet below the ocean surface, there is no light. It is black dark in a way that you and I cannot imagine. So even if you did get below 1,000 feet, your ability to actually search within that facility or within that area is extremely limited. You would need extremely powerful searchlights, but even then, the amount of distance that they can actually illuminate is extremely limited. Now, you heard our commentator there talking about the what was going on inside the vessel, inside Titan. So he's talking about condensation. Remember, the men were going down for 8 hours and then back again. At most, it was going to be a sort of, 16-hour journey maximum. They've been there for days in this tiny box, in this tin can, breathing in and out. And the carbon dioxide, you know, I believe they don't have what's known as a scrubber, something to actually clean out the oxygen as it's recycled within the craft. That's nothing to say about the extremely cramped conditions they're in. I saw some photographs of what the inside of this vessel looks like. Did you realize that there are 5 men in it, yet at any one time, only one of them can extend his legs in a sitting position? So they would have to take it in turns to extend their legs and then go back to a cross-legged position. They've been in that position or in that rotation for days now. Just try sitting cross-legged for 8 minutes. Never mind 8 hours. Never mind 4 days. It's painful. And remember, the oxygen as well is also determined a lot on their mental state. If they all remain calm, cool, and collected, the oxygen will last its full course. If one or other of them starts to get frantic, they will use up more oxygen. Okay, let's play. We heard about the soundings, and there's been a lot of talk about that they're picking up these soundings. So let's explore a little bit what that is and the possibilities that may provoke. So, Reid, if we could play audio file 3, which will give us what exactly they mean when they're talking about these soundings.
What they might be doing is sending out repeated patterned tappings, okay? And you would do that in order to distinguish your noise from the general din of the ocean. Now remember, if they're on the seafloor, we are a long way down. We're almost 4 kilometers down. But let's imagine they are on the surface and they are doing these tappings. At the surface up here, they have dropped sonar buoys. So these are listening devices from aeroplanes, okay? And they will be listening for these tapping sounds. It's just possible that they are able then to geolocate the position of the sub. And the way that they would do that is that they would time the receipt at the different sonar buoys of this signal. It's a bit like GPS. You have satellites in the sky. They send the radio signals down. You have a chip in your mobile phone. And from the different arrival times of those signals, you can work out where you are in the street. It's a bit different, nothing like as accurate as well. If they've got just one sonar buoy picking up these sounds, the experts that I've spoken to said they can probably geolocate to about 1 to 2 kilometers. If they have several sonar buoys up here, all receiving that information, they might be able to get the search area down to 100 meters. And then what you do is you put down a remotely operated vehicle like the one that we show here. It has active sonar, and it would search that box. It would look for potentially targets within that box.
Thank you, Reid. I don't know about you, but listening to that, it doesn't really fill me with great confidence. Remember, they're searching an area the size of Connecticut twice over. And these soundings may be picking up various sounds. The one thing that we must remember about the ocean is that sound travels a great distance in the ocean, in a way it doesn't travel on land. That's why whale song, for example, can travel many, many miles from where the whales are. So they may be hearing these soundings, and it may indeed come from this craft, or it may not. But even if it does, they may be many, many miles away and many thousands of feet under the ocean. And that's the other problem. It's one thing locating the sound. The next thing is actually trying to get down into the ocean and find the vessel. As I said at the top of the hour, the time is running out. The oxygen supply, as I speak to you now, is probably ending. The next piece of video I'm going to play is from a doctor who will tell you what happens next. What happens when the oxygen stops? Do they still have a chance? Even if we were able to locate them on the soundings now and get a vessel down to them, would we still be able to find them alive? Reid, if we could play audio file 4.
Well, I mean, even if they are rescued, let's say rescued after the oxygen levels drop too low. You know, they're not going to be able to rescue themselves. They'll have to be carried out. And depending on how long and how low the oxygen has been, will determine, you know, what the long-term outcome is. Can people survive after exposure to those conditions? Yes, they could have damage to the nervous system or heart and extended time. So really it's going to be a gradual deterioration. So I don't think they should give up. I think they should keep their efforts going, you know, to see if they can get them up in time. Absolutely. The diameter of the submersible is actually significantly less than this chamber. So because it's the confined space, you can imagine, you know, how difficult it is to control the interior environment, you know, the humidity, the temperature.
Okay, Reid, we'll just end that there. We're going to play a little bit more, but I think we'll just end it there. That was Dr. Kenneth Ledez, who was basically saying that, yes, they would be in an unconscious state probably soon. And that would mean that they would have to be retrieved from the vessel if indeed we can find the vessel. Now, I'm not here to sort of give a morbid overview of what's happening. I was thinking about this from our Catholic faith perspective. What does this all mean? Why is this story gripped so? Why are we so fascinated by it? And when I say we, I mean the world, you and me and everybody else. There isn't a media outlet either side of the Atlantic that isn't covering this story. All the phone-in radio stations this side of the Atlantic, nobody wants to talk about anything else. They want to talk about this vessel. And I wondered why. It's not the first time that vessels go missing. It's not the first time that people drown. What is it about this that is attracting people? And I wondered if it's the first time in many, many years, in one of the rare occasions in the modern world, that we're able to talk about death. Because that's what we're talking about here. Even if the men are survived and we're able to rescue them and get them out, we are all with them, in a sense, in this vessel. And we're all having to come to terms with that idea that we're dying. Now, these men may die in the next hour, next 2 hours, who knows? But one thing is certain, we're all going to die. And that's a fact that modern life, and certainly the modern media, tries to keep hidden from all of us. Now, we Christians, we Catholics, we have a slightly different view on this. You know, I mean, we were talking about St. Jerome this week. Well, St. Jerome, if you ever saw a picture of St. Jerome, a painting, you'd often see him working on his manuscripts of the Bible on the Vulgate. But in the background, you would see a skull. Because like many of the church fathers, he would have a skull in front of him because he wanted to remember his death. Memento mori is a Christian idea. Not in a morbid sense, but to remind us that what we have here is not the end. What we have here is not everything that really matters. Whether you're wealthy, whether you're poor, whether you're rich, whether you're beautiful, whether you're a movie star, whether you're homeless, it doesn't matter. We're all going to die. But we also need to live. So I think that's why this story has caught our imagination. I'll leave you with a quote from St. Paul. If we live, we live to the Lord. And if we die to the Lord. So then, whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. To me, that's a consolation. Now, when we come back, we'll be speaking to a military chaplain and finding out about his role in recruiting more military chaplains. Stay tuned to the Charlie Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio.
What's going to change the human heart is the proclamation of the gospel and the power of the Holy Spirit.
Archangel Radio, changing hearts, one program at a time.
Hello and welcome back to the Charlie Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I hope your Thursday is going well and we are so grateful for your company. Now, we've just been speaking of about facing death and those five men who are trapped in that vessel somewhere in the North Atlantic. But when speaking of facing death, there are a group of men and women who face this possibility square on as part of their day-to-day professional work. Of course, I'm talking about the military. In the wider world, there has also been a growing appreciation of military chaplains, especially so, I would say, in the last decades. Now, of course, military chaplains have always been valued by the military personnel that they serve. But increasingly, there is an awareness among civilians of the risks and dangers that priests in particular expose themselves to as they minister to their flocks, not least in battle zones. Now, my next guest was ordained a priest in 2004, and after serving as a pastor in New York City, Father Peter Pomposello is today a Catholic priest with the Archdiocese for the Military Services. He serves in the U.S. Army also as a priest recruiter. His mission is to bring more priests and seminarians to serve in the United States Army and Army Reserves as Catholic or indeed Orthodox priest chaplains. Now, as a military chaplain, of course, he has celebrated many masses, weddings, and baptisms for U.S. soldiers and their families. But in addition, he was deployed to the Middle East to minister to military personnel in harm's way. And if that wasn't enough, while serving in Alaska alongside U.S. paratroopers, he too jumped out of airplanes, which is quite terrifying. And he joins me down the line today. Father Peter, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Kevin, thank you for that introduction. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Father Peter, you deal with people who have to face death on occasion. That's part and parcel of their professional work. And at the moment, the whole world's attention is on that vessel out in the North Atlantic. What do you say to soldiers, for example, when you were in the Middle East, when they were in combat and they knew that that day might be their last? What was the sort of thing as a priest, as a Catholic priest, that you would say to them?
You know, I'm so glad you're asking about the guys, you're talking about the guys in that submarine. I've been praying for them. And I think there's something that comes inherently to everybody. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And there's a lot of wisdom, I bet, please God, in that submarine right now. And certainly on the battlefield when men and women are called to serve in it. And we have an expression, we say, when it gets real, when it gets real, when there's an incoming attack, or if there's, or in the aftermath of something happening, and is this going to happen to me? You know, let's say a patrol meets contact and they have a fatality. It sobers everybody up. And I just tell them, I said, you know, this is the time to pray and hope. This is it. This is where you put your trust in the Lord, and he'll do everything else for you. You just got to do your job and do it well. And whatever's going to happen is going to happen. There's a line that comes to mind when you say this. There's a line from C.S. Lewis when he talks about in the Screwtape Letters, one demon is trying to tutor another demon to tempting others, and the demon thinks, oh, this is great. My subject, the one that I'm trying to tempt to come to hell, is going to battle. So this is going to be great. He's going to be scared, and he's like, what are you, an idiot? He says, this could draw him closer to God. He says, this is a terrible thing. It might even draw him closer to the Lord. So I think, and I've seen that. I've seen men and women take their faith and their relationship with the Lord even more seriously because of the urgency of the situation. At the same time, I will say, though, it's dangerous. It's a job occupation in that some people become callous and they become very upset and they turn the other way. And I think that's the biggest danger. It's not the bombs and the bullets. It's the moral danger that soldiers suffer from, that fear, that doubt, separation from family, separation from the sacraments, those things.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, the moral danger of becoming battle hardened, I guess, or maybe even cynical or brutalized by military conflict.
I'll go even further from that. Like, it's not just the front lines, but our soldiers every day. And thank you for recognizing their service and the service of all military men and women, all, you know, serving their country. The thing behind that is that every day, you know, they're called to sacrifice time away from their families, a lot of time away from their families. They're separated for training. They're separated for school's work. And it's dangerous. It's very dangerous for a husband and a wife to be regularly separate from each other. The wife ultimately becomes, geographically, she's a single mother. She's trying to corral her kids and do the best she can for her kids while typically I'm saying, you know, like the male is the soldier and here's the female, the wife at home raising the kids. And there, her husband is off running around, and he's not there for the daily routines. And one of the greatest dangers is they have to communicate more with each other, not less, but even more with each other, and be more intentional so that they can keep a strong marriage.
I never thought about that, but presumably a lot of your priestly duty as well is with the families, trying to keep families together in this sort of situation.
Absolutely. I've had the privilege to serve I served 5 years at Fort Campbell, and that's where I did all of my deployments back and forth to the Middle East. And I was on a regular schedule where I would deploy very regularly in support of Christmas for a couple of months. Then I'd come home, I'd do laundry, and I'd be right back out the door to support Easter for a couple of months. And I did that for 5 years. And in doing that, I got to see this progression in the pew. I'd be at the chapel at Fort Campbell, and here I am praying Mass on Sunday, and there's the family. You know, there's mom, dad, and the kids. And then a week comes by, and then it's like, oh, dad's gone. And now it's just mom with the kids. And then I had the ultimate privilege to be able to find the husband in theater, to find that soldier in theater. And I would see them, and I'd say Mass for them, separate from, now we're both separate from Fort Campbell, and we'd have Mass overseas. And then eventually, thanks be to God, you know, everybody came home and we'd be back together again. But that progression, that ebb and flow of going back and forth was really quite a privilege.
Absolutely. Now, you were ordained a priest in 2004, but it was a few years later that you enlisted in the Army. How come?
Well, so I had been, actually, I had prior service. I was in the Army. During college, I was commissioned through the Reserve Officer Training Program, and I was in the reserves for 8 years, and I enjoyed it, and I had a taste for the Army, and I always had my sights set on becoming a chaplain, and that was my first thought in going to the seminary. My first bishop was open to it. Then he passed away, and then my second bishop was not open to it. And I served 10 years in the Archdiocese of New York, and I loved it. It was great. I had the opportunity to be a pastor, and it really helped form me even more as a priest and as a pastor in ministry. And then ultimately now my current Archbishop Cardinal Dolan, he gave me permission to do this special work, and I'm able to do this, and I'm really pleased to do it.
And you didn't just join the army, you joined the paratroopers, right?
Oh, I always volunteer. So every paratrooper, we have an expression in the army. Paratroopers are soldiers who volunteer twice. You know, every man and woman in service, you know, they write a blank check. I don't know if you've ever heard this analogy. It's a great one. That every sailor, every soldier, every airman writes a blank check. They give a blank check with a signature, their own signature on it, to the people of the United States of America. And they say, listen, I'm gonna do whatever it takes, up to and including the price of my very own life, to serve you and to defend this country. But paratroopers do it twice. They really do. They volunteer to come in the army, and then it's every paratrooper voluntarily says, yes, I'm willing for this training to become a paratrooper, to jump out of aircraft and flight. And we know the hazards of this choice, but we do it anyway because it's part of the mission. It's a great community. I love the airborne community. I love being a paratrooper.
And it's not just jumping out of planes. I mean, it's jumping out of a plane into a war zone, which is a completely different kettle of fish, as we say. But when you went to Alaska to join the battalion up there, had you jumped out of planes before? I mean, had you done para jumps at any time?
No.
Prior to that?
I had no prior experience in jumping out of airplanes at all. And they train you for it. In the training, though, a lot of people argue about the value of paratrooping. They say, is this really necessary? I mean, in this day and age, is this really the best way to seize an airfield by exposing all this risk of paratroopers jumping out of airplanes? And I had a commander in the airborne community once explain. He said, this is great training. If none of these paratroopers ever jump into combat, it doesn't matter, because it's a matter of life and death. Every training event is truly a matter of life and death for paratroopers to get on a plane, exit the aircraft, and then get back down on the ground go from the sky to the ground again, and then continue their mission. There's a lot more risk in that than just driving a truck to the middle of a field and then doing the same work. And he said it gets the soldiers' heart rates up, and it puts them in a stressful situation that, short of being shot at, This is excellent training for them to deal with the rigors of soldiering.
And did you feel that when you jumped out of the plane for the first time?
Absolutely. Actually, you know what? My first jump, I was so focused on my first jump. I can't say I was scared for the first jump, because I was just so focused on all the actions of what I had to do to get out the door, to check my canopy, to control it, land on the ground. And then as soon as I landed, I was like, wow, I got to do that again. Oh boy, what did I sign up for? Here we go. And it's a little stressful, but you get over it. I hope this doesn't come across as bravado or anything like that, but you really do. After a certain amount of jumps, it becomes like driving a car. Driving a car is, you know, in itself, it's a dangerous thing. You know, you're driving fast. You there's a lot of things that can go wrong in driving a car, but it becomes routine after a while. And you become very comfortable with driving. And that can also be the danger of it, because then you start texting, you're reading something, you're distracted, and that's when bad things happen. And it's the same thing for a paratrooper. You get over the initial fear of it, and then you can be careful. You got to be careful you don't become complacent with how routine it can become.
Absolutely. You're talking to somebody, you have to confess, Father, who did one parachute jump. And my experience was very different. When I hit the ground, I kissed it and said, never again. It was that bad. It was that bad. Listen, we're going to have to go
for
a break.
Come on, Kevin, I'll get you out again. We should go and jump together again.
No, I'll go to confession. I'll not go on a parachute jump. Father Peter, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back shortly after. If you've got a question for Father Peter about life in the military, life as a military chaplain, then call us, 888-928-0881, or text me on 251-928-2111. We'll be back straight after these words. back to Attorney Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I'm in fascinating conversation with Father Peter Pomposello, who is a Catholic priest with the Archdiocese for the Military Services and has been deployed abroad in the Middle East, and is also, as we've discovered, a regular jumper out of planes. Yes, he's a paratrooper. He's a master jumper, I'm told, which I will maybe talk a little bit more with him. We've got a couple of questions for you, Father Peter. The first one is, how does one become a military priest? Good question. I mean, your average parish priest, does he just write to the military, or how does it work?
Oh, that's a great question. I'd love to encourage your listeners to follow our efforts to bring priests into the Army. They can go on Instagram, fr.unclesam, Father Uncle Sam, and on Instagram, and you could get a good idea of what the process is like, and you could message me directly there too. But basically, the process is for a man feels called. It's like a call within a call, and he has this call to serve, and he wants to serve in this particular way. I call it outdoor ministry. And that's not to say that you're going to spend 20 years sleeping on the ground if you join the Army, but there's a sense of adventure, and there's a sense of real sacrifice. You know, you sacrifice time away from the stability of family and a parish to go where the Army sends you, and you'll need the permission of your bishop. It's a long ask. You need the permission of your bishop. You need to be vetted and made sure, you know, they're going to check you out medically, that you can serve physically. And then after you've been given permission from your bishop and you've gone through the board process, then you'll have to go away for training, and you'll have to be trained as an Army officer, where it's a direct commission, kind of like doctors, lawyers, and dentists. They have a skill set. So clergy, mm-hmm. priests have a skill set that the Army's looking for, and they'll directly commission you. But you do have to do the work of a staff officer as well. That's how you contribute to the fight. And that's really, as a priest, that's how you make yourself relevant. You add to the value of your unit and the business of soldiering, which is why I became a jump master, because I knew I could contribute beyond, you know, they expect me to be there to hear confessions and say mass. They get that. But when they say, wait a minute, he's a jump master. He can teach those classes, or he can take that stick of soldiers and he can get them out the door. That's now I'm not just dead weight going out of the plane. I'm actually leading soldiers, and that puts the priesthood in a whole new perspective. And it also adds a value. It's a force multiplier, we like to say, for the good of the unit.
Wow, I wasn't aware of that, Father Peter. I mean, I expected, as you said, all the priestly duties to be carried out, and probably that would keep you busy enough. But you actually, when you say you're part of the staff, part of the officer corps, you're involved also in other duties then, which are about the military morale of the men under you, and women under your charge.
Yes, in the U.S. Army, we serve, every chaplain in the United States military, we serve because of the First Amendment. Because for freedom of speech and freedom of religion. And I often, when I would give an orientation to brand new soldiers, I'd have brand new soldiers in front of me, and I'd stand in front of them in my Army uniform, and I'd tell them, hey, I'm your chaplain, and I'm here for your religion, not my religion, your religion. And they kind of look at me, and I say, I'm a Catholic priest, and I can provide anything that you need as a Catholic priest. If that's your religion, that's great, and we could work with that. But if you're Jewish, if you're Muslim, if you're a Protestant, I'm here to make sure that I can advise you where your needs can be satisfied. And that's very important. I take it very seriously. You know, I would work to make sure that Protestant ministers would come to my area of operation and serve my Protestant soldiers so that they, and that's my way to love them. And that's my way to let those Protestant soldiers know, wow, you know, the priest actually makes sure that we get a Protestant minister out here. He's not just like shoving his brand of Christianity down our throat and like, yeah, sorry, there's nobody else here for you. Because that's my responsibility. That's a great staff responsibility for me as a chaplain.
Absolutely. Now, you were, I believe, in the Bronx, I think in New York City before you joined the military. You've been in the military now many years. Is it a one-way street? I mean, do you think you could go back to an ordinary civilian parish, or do you think you're in the military now? That's your calling. That's where you're at.
Oh, that's a beautiful question. I thank God every day that I get to serve, and I serve at the pleasure of my bishop. My bishop holds all the cards. He could call me. I mean, as soon as this phone call's over, he could call me and say, "Hey, I know you like the Army, but I need you to come home." And in obedience, that's what I'd be called to do. All things being equal, though, I've been a chaplain now 9 years. I'd love to do the rest of it. I'd love to do the 20 years. And there's this unwritten rule among priests in the military where we do the 20 years and we make this a gift to our diocese. We all go home to our home diocese. Nobody is permanently assigned to the archdiocese for the military services, save the bishops themselves. We go there, right. We serve for a time. I joke about it. We serve in the military until we're too old, too sick, or too dead, but we always go home. And then when we go home, it's beautiful. We can make a gift to our diocese that I've provided for my own needs and I can continue to provide for the church out of what I've been blessed with from the good of the taxpayers in my service to the country. So I can, my health care is taken care of. I don't need a salary. I have a pension. And that's a longstanding kind of unwritten tradition among many, many, many priest chaplains in the Navy and the Air Force and in the Army, that they go home and they don't really take a full salary or they don't take a salary at all for the good of their parishes until then they retire, at the age of, say, 75 or beyond that.
You're listening to the voice of Father Peter Pomposello, who is a Catholic priest with the Archdiocese for the Military Services. I have another question for you, Father Peter. What percentage of the U.S. military is Catholic? Any idea?
That's a great question. It's about, roughly on paper, it's about 25%, maybe a little bit less. I will say this, though, as far as numbers go, we, in my experience, 9 years now, we outnumber any other denomination of Christianity by far. So when it comes to services and getting everybody, providing for everybody's needs, talking about the First Amendment again, providing religious services on a Sunday on an Army post, by far the Catholic community is always the largest number of participants. It's the largest number of students in catechetical ministry because the children of the soldiers need First Communion and confirmation preparation and religious education, and we provide for all of that. That's a deep part of our mission and ministry. But we certainly outnumber any other group, and it's beautiful because I think it testifies to the portability of the church, the universal
Absolutely.
Nature of the church. Here we are, soldiers from all 50 states with all different accents and all different experiences of the church from their home parish, but there we are together around the altar, around the priest, because we're Catholic.
Amen. It's funny, you're reminding me, I wrote something about the First World War chaplain, Father Willie Doyle. I don't know if you're familiar with this story. And in that research, I came across a staggering statistic that was reported in the Catholic press after the First World War, which was that during that conflict, 40,000 British military personnel converted to the Catholic faith. And they directly attributed that to the good example of Catholic chaplains.
That's outstanding. That's beautiful.
Father?
I was going to say there's this opportunity. As a priest, as a chaplain, every chaplain has an opportunity to go where soldiers themselves don't even want to be. And when you're out there in the rain with them or sitting on an airplane and those doors are going to open and you have to jump out, when you're doing difficult things with those soldiers, you're making a gift of yourself to them, and the soldiers know it. They know it intuitively. They're like, this guy doesn't have to be here with us. He's here for us. And that attracts them to continue the conversation and say, "Hey, I want what you want. I want what you have. Like, let me come. Can I come to your church? Tell me more about this."
Wonderful. Absolutely beautiful. Talk to me, Father Peter, about some of the wonderful military chaplains, maybe the U.S. military chaplains of the past that have inspired you in your ministry.
Oh, Father Emile Capon is the first one to come to mind. I had the privilege to bury.
So just for our audience, Father Peter, paint a little thumbnail. We're talking Korean War, right?
Yeah, Korean War. Father Emile Capon died in service to soldiers in the sickness and in the dire conditions of a prisoner of war camp. And what a beautiful gift of self-sacrifice to those soldiers. And I've actually met soldiers that he served. I've met old Korean War veterans that told me, I was in that camp or I knew Father Capone before he was captured. And it, what a beautiful connection. But what a Christ-like offering that Emil Capone made to serve others at the detriment of his own health and his own welfare, and to make sure that he cared for his soldiers in such dire conditions where they're not only imprisoned, but they're also injured. I don't think there's any greater fear for a soldier than to be injured and imprisoned. There couldn't be anything worse for a soldier other than death itself.
Absolutely. And maybe Father Vincent as well from the Vietnam conflict.
Yeah, so Father Capodanno, his cause for canonization, is as well as Emil Capone, is also up, and he's up for canonization. Father Capodanno, I have an interesting connection to him. He was a Marine chaplain, but he spent a lot of time where I grew up in Staten Island, New York, and I'm very familiar with, you know, him and his service, and there's a street named for him in the town where I grew up. And, and again, just a heroic, virtuous priest there for his Marines at the detriment of his own life and his own safety.
And as you say, the witness that is given is not just to the Catholics in service, it's to everybody in the service. It's to the wider community, just how much, and maybe we shouldn't be surprised. I came across another interesting statistic, which you may be interested in, Father Peter. By December 1914, when the First World War had been on a few months, the London Times reported that 87 Catholic priests and 127 nuns had been awarded the French Légion d'Honneur for services rendered to French forces. And the quote was, "Everywhere the priests have been distinguished for their heroism, their devotion to the patriotic cause shared by many members of religious orders, both men and women." And the thing to remember is, no doubt you're aware, Father Peter, this was a government that was anti-Catholic.
It's amazing. It's amazing how attractive the truth really is when these men and women, those sisters, those fathers, those priests live their vocation authentically, it attracts others to it. I've had the opportunity to, like, I've had Protestants come up to me not knowing anything, not knowing that I can't marry them because I'm a Catholic priest. I can't do a Protestant wedding. But when they find a connection with you and they say, "Hey, you know, hey, can you do my wedding?" And I don't say no. I just say, "Oh, hey, let's talk about that. And let's go out to dinner. Let me meet your fiance." And then over dinner, I'll unpack the fact that, like, "No, we can't, I can't do the wedding, but let's talk about marriage. Let's talk about you guys." And here I am doing Catholic wedding prep for these Protestant kids that are really hungry for a great direction in their life as they're starting a life together as husband and wife. And all those opportunities come by just being there as a chaplain.
I mean, you're a wonderful advertisement for this wonderful vocation within a vocation, Father Peter, because you sound as if you're really joyful about it. It's really where God wants you to be right now.
I do. You know, I love it. I really do. I mean, it was a boyhood dream to be a paratrooper, to be a soldier. I had been a soldier before I came into the seminary, and it's just been one consolation after another. The Lord's really kind of shown me, this is what I'm calling you to do. And He gives us these attractions and desires to be lived. And I'm kind of over, when I was younger, I had to get over the idea of, like, "Oh, do I want this for me? Am I overthinking this?" It's like, "No, the heck with this. Like, God's put me here and I'm going to jump in with both feet, literally with a parachute on my back. Like, let's go, let's do this." And it's really a wonderful ministry. And I hope, you know, this time, thank you for this time in the interview. And I hope, some young men or people who know out there, they're your brothers, they're your cousins, you know, they're your sons. They might be attracted to the priesthood. Don't be afraid to encourage them, and don't be afraid to get them in touch with me at father.unclesam, fr.unclesam on Instagram. And I'd love to help walk with them and help them discover their vocation.
Absolutely. And there'll be people listening to this who, what sort of support are you getting from the hierarchy?
That's a great question, because obviously, they need their priests. The hierarchy need their priests in parishes. They need their priests in their ministry that they're looking for. So the analogy I like to use is, instead of my showing up to the battle and saying, "Hey, I need a couple of guys. I got to take some of your guys over here and so that they can come and be chaplains." It's like, wait a minute. I need these guys over here. I need them in my parishes. So instead of showing up and asking for priests to come and serve, I've found great success and great cooperation with the hierarchy when I foster vocations at the college senior level, young men just thinking about their vocation. And now it's like, yeah, I think I want to do what you do, Father. And I'm like, sit right here. Let's write an email. And now I bring them to the hierarchy and say, hey, this guy's thinking about being a priest and he wants to serve in the army. So now I'm not asking them for one of their priests or seminarians. I'm bringing somebody to the fight. I'm bringing somebody else. And that's always well received.
Absolutely. And it's an absolutely beautiful ministry. One more story before we go, Father. I just want to share it with you, all these researches I did. It was reported in a British newspaper, start of the First World War, scene of a French railway station, lots of injured and wounded. One of them was crying out for a priest. Nurse didn't know what to do. And another person lying wounded said, I'm a priest, bring him to me. They carried the man over to him. The priest heard the man's confession, and shortly after, both were dead. And the newspaper reported that the nurses around them dropped to their feet. Praying.
The wounded together. Healer. I mean, there's Christ. There's Christ beaten and bloodied and bruised, walking the way of the cross and ministering to the women of Jerusalem, you know, ministering to others on the way. And there's that priest doing that from a gurney as he himself is dying. What a powerful witness.
Yeah, and the witness, and this is a secular newspaper reporting this. So Father Peter, it's been wonderful meeting you, if only on air. I won't be jumping out of any planes. I have one question, which was, can you hear confessions while jumping out of airplanes? I'll leave
it's
that
better
one
to
for
do
you.
Better to do it beforehand.
Better to do it beforehand, if only to make sure you get your penance in before you land. Father Peter,
thanks
very
so
quickly,
much,
again, give out the details of where people can find out about you and your ministry.
Yes, please come follow our recruiting efforts at fr.unclesam. That's father.unclesam, or fr.unclesam on Instagram. And you can follow us, message us, and know that you're in our prayers. Please keep us in your prayers for vocation.
We definitely will. Father Peter, we're about to say the Divine Mercy Chaplet. We'll remember you and your ministry and want to give you thanks for all your service to the country and service to the church. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
God bless you. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you.
Okay, when we come back, we will be praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio.